the trust of, we are responsible for the trust of other people. And at the same time, we have to know how to keep this trust, how to go with the correct way.
When you are the custodian of something, it becomes a responsibility on your shoulder to take care of it.
Yeah.
And in our culture, it has been a sort of a tradition in our culture that this concept is very important, that you have to take care of it. Even if you, as my friend, entrust me with a little thing like a book, I have to take care of that book no matter what. I have to keep it as precious as one of my things so that make it clarified for everyone that this concept of entrust is something very important.
Yeah, and it hurts when people forget about it, when people take them for granted.
Yeah.
When we talk about being a trustworthy person, the first thing that comes to our mind is being trustworthy with objects. Mm-hmm. Like if I'm trusted with keeping an object, which is yours, I have to know this responsibility. Yeah. And when people do not follow this, this common rule, this social rule, it really hurts.
So, you know, like the health, like, you know, this is the analogy of your body and the country.
Yeah, exactly.
Both of them have been entrusted to you. But then the question is, how do I have to and how am I supposed to take care of them? I am the trustee and these things are entrusted with me. But then what are my responsibilities? You know, as for my body, yes, I have to take care of it. For example, we take care of what we eat and we take care of what we actually, supposedly, we're supposed to take care of them.
Yeah.
But when it comes to your country, things are a bit complicated.
You know, going with the same metaphor, we can say when we talk about our body, when we think about our body and how to protect it, we have to go through a process of changes, of taking care of every sign, every symptom that shows we have to, okay, if I'm coughing today, I have to go for fixing this problem. Mm-hmm. I have to go for solving this matter. So the same goes with the country, but it gets complicated because here, I think a lot of other things come in. Like in the battles, we can see that some people, rare people, let's say, especially in the Islamic countries, rare and a few people are going to just not protect their country. They are taking the side of the enemy. And what is behind these decisions, behind these wrong decisions? I think it's the matter of greed, the matter of sometimes people do not want to
ignorance,
just be scared.
Maybe
they don't want to be in the danger, in the risk, at the risk of problems.
They don't want to feel out of state.
Yeah, the same happened in the battlefield of Karbala with Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Very true.
Those people knew that they are trusted with taking care of their imam, of the person that God has sent to them, of the grandchild of
the
prophet.
Absolute light. Like, you see, I always wonder that, okay, such a person in front of you, and he is the absolute light.
Yeah.
Like, you, even if you
how could you not see
it? Yeah, how could you not see that? Even if you do not have an eye, you can feel that. Even Imam Hussein alayhi salam told them that your bellies are filled with haram food. That's why you cannot see.
Yeah, what broke that trust was the greed.
Yeah.
Like someone has promised us to give us, I don't know, that so-called land. The greed or the want of this materialistic life. They wanted more of these materials. Mm-hmm. They wanted more of this world. While they knew and they were praying for the prophet. So, okay, this is the grandchild of that same prophet.
I was too proud to see the truth and prostrate to you until I took the first step. And that's when you opened the doors for me. Now, Allah, I realize what I was missing by being far from you.
We're talking about when we are entrusted with things, we're responsible towards them. And this responsibility sometimes goes beyond your capacity.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes it's so huge that you feel so, so, so responsible.
Yeah. And you know, Asma, during these times of war, when I was talking to my students, when I was talking to my friends, to my younger friends, let's say, they would say, okay, you're saying that I have to know my own responsibility. Okay, what should I do? We can simplify this responsibility, this understanding mm-hmm. that we are trusted with our country into some different strategies, into different actions that we can make. This question was repeatedly asked from me that, okay, I'm young. I don't know. I do not have much of experience. Yeah. Even we had not experienced
war. And it's not
war.
A battlefield. Like, if it was to take a weapon in my hand yeah. and go, maybe many of them would have done that.
Yeah, exactly. But it then was when it's the simplest way yeah. to just go and fight in the physical
it's
war.
It's very direct.
Yeah.
But now, San, it was a hybrid war, you know. It's not just about weapons and missiles. Yeah. No, it goes beyond that. It goes on the level of, you know, the cyber level. Yeah. That also is a different sort of
yeah,
war.
Exactly.
And then we have this media. And then you are responsible even in there. I do believe that nowadays soldiers do not go to battlefield. They take their phones in their hands and then they start.
So true.
They start creating stuff for people, like food for the thought of people.
Yeah.
And this is the one which might be very dangerous.
And this is more important.
Very much more important. That's why we have to have media literacy, and that's why we have to be prepared to be a soldier in that battlefield.
Yeah, exactly. Media is playing a major role today. And us, as the young people, even just advocating the truth, just showing the face of our country, let's say, that this country is not the same thing that our enemy
yeah.
with much of the media,
mm-hmm.
with the platforms and many, many sources that are available only for them and less for us.
Mm-hmm.
Our country is not the same. So this media can play a major role using the tool of phones, the tool of internet, and at the same time, just in the country, being the supporters of other people.
Yeah.
What I would always...
Backing each other's up.
Yeah.
This is very, what we saw during these 12 days.
Yeah.
Like, it was very interesting to see that people care for each other. Like, there were many people in the cities that were so affected.
Yeah.
Like, there was this danger of being killed.
Yeah, yeah.
But then, since the taxis were maybe there were less number of taxis out there. I saw people that they brought out their cars to help people. Like they said, and when you ask the driver, why
yeah.
are you doing this? Then he or she would say that there are many nurses or doctors wishing to go to the hospital, but they do not see any
yeah,
cars.
The
so
same
that's
happened
why
with the hotels.
We come out. Yeah, so it was very interesting. Like you see, sometimes the Western societies do not have a perfect reading of the Eastern
yeah.
culture and societies. In what way? In the way that, for us, land is not just a piece of land.
Yeah.
Any land. It could be anywhere. Okay, if not in this place, I go somewhere. No, it's not that. It's like your family.
Yeah, it's precious.
Are you supposed to give up on even a member of your family? No, never. You would never
so
do that. You would give your entire soul and life for that one member of
yeah.
your family. So it's a different thing, and we feel responsible toward each other because we do believe that all of these things have been entrusted with us. So if I want to sum it all up in one sentence, if today's episode would make you think more about the things that you're entrusted with and that are very precious, then I guess we've done our job for today. Because what we wanted to say was that your heart is a precious thing that have been entrusted into your chest. Your brain, the same. Your body, the same. Your friends, your family, your dear ones, plus your country. All of the things that you have been through in your own country is a story that happens only in that place. So that place have been the witness of my life, of every moment of my lifetime. Whatever that I've been through, this piece of land has been a witness to it. So it's so precious to me, and I'm responsible
yeah.
towards it. And this responsibility would not stop to the point that everything is okay. No, it goes beyond that. Even when it's not in the peace and in the hard times, we're going to be together and stay united and take care of each other because we are each other's responsibility.
Yeah, for sure.
That's the thing that our religion teaches us. And we practice it, hopefully, inshallah. So this was all for today. I hope you have just enjoyed it. Until another episode of Youth Station. Wassalamu alaikum
wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that, inshallah, in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa
rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Such familiar cries. I see Hussein in its story as if I should. Just like Zainab, but in her chest there is an age. She does not stand chained up in Sham. Zainab does not have a title, but like Zainab from the fire, the ashes turned her skin pale. From this darkness roses wither as two fire together, as if they wanted a Zina. In Zahra they found another.
My mourning is never ending, for tears my eyes always waiting. Whenever one Ashura ends, another is just beginning.
Not long after weeks or more, striking her head in a prison. My son, in a prison darker than space, where even air is forbidden. Imam Qadhim is wrapped in chains, yearning the peace of his coffin, yearning the peace of his coffin.
Helpless yearning for a helper, strangers do not know a stranger.
Changing the ground beneath the ground, even the air is
destinies are written.
The month of no food and water.
We watch the weight of Islam tilt as demolished are its pillars. I watch the killer of Marhab
and the conqueror of Khaybar struck on the head, and watching this reminds me of Ali Akbar.
A strike from which the heaven shook, descends a book, ascends a book.
It looks like Ali Akbar and
Ali Akbar, like him would look.
My morning is never ending.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Even in the face of unprecedented devastation, the Palestinian resistance continues to stand firm, undaunted and unbroken. In recent days, as Israeli airstrikes have killed dozens of civilians in Gaza, including children and aid seekers sheltering in schools, resistance groups have also launched coordinated attacks on Israeli military positions in Khan Yunis and southern Gaza. These operations carried out by factions like the Quds Brigades are not just military responses. They are declarations of survival, defiance, and the refusal to surrender. Despite the overwhelming firepower and international backing for the occupation, the Palestinian people continue to resist through armed struggle, through mourning, and through the unyielding belief that justice is not a fantasy, but a right worth fighting for. Welcome to Spotlight. I am Bahman Nouraei. Let us begin with a short report.
The Palestinian resistance persists in its retaliatory operations against the Israeli occupation forces across the Gaza Strip. The Al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas, announced its fighters targeted a Zionist infantry force with missiles. Ensuing clashes resulted in IOF casualties in the Shuja'iyah neighborhood east of the Gaza City. The Al-Qassam Brigades has released a video of attacks on Israeli soldiers and vehicles near Gaza City. The footage shows Israeli soldiers being sniped at in Tal el-Montar and clashes in Shuja'iyya, with a tank and command post being targeted. Abu Obaida, the brigade spokesman, commented on the recent operation in Beit Hanun, which killed at least 5 Israeli soldiers. He characterized the operation as a significant setback for the occupation army, which believed the area was secure. He stressed that the resistance in Gaza will persist in inflicting losses on the Israeli regime. Abu Obaida asserted that the Palestinian people and their resistance fighters will determine the future, warning the IOF against remaining in Gaza. The Qassam operation in Beit Hanun was not merely a tactical maneuver. It conveyed a dual strategic message with both military and intelligence implications. The operation coincided with Netanyahu's visit to Washington, representing multifaceted embarrassment at various levels. Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement says the operation showed the strength of the Palestinian resistance and caused fear in the enemy. The Yemeni movement noted that the operation occurred amid escalated enemy attacks and a crippling blockade in Gaza. Israeli newspaper Yedioth Ahronot has reported that the death toll among the IOF soldiers in Gaza has risen, with 31 killed since the occupation army restarted its genocide on March 18th. Israeli Channel 13 says Operation Gidon has failed to meet its goals, questioning the outcomes aside from significant military casualties and destruction in Gaza.
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Saad Shah, author and commentator, joining us from Belfast. And Mazen Qumsi, a Palestinian scientist and author, joining us from Bethlehem.
The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, very good to have you on this program once again. I'm going to start my talk with Saeb. How are the Palestinian resistance factions such as Hamas's Al-Qassam brigades still able to carry out precision strikes against the Israeli forces despite Gaza's siege and infrastructure collapse?
Hello to you and your guests and the audience. That, in short, I summarize it in the will of the resistance to fight. They are standing in their land and they understand very well the political designs being thrown about by Trump and Netanyahu. Even they were bragging about it yesterday, the transfer of the Palestinian, the cleansing of Palestine, the annexation of the West Bank, and that's from 1917 till today, the Palestinian resistance is being developing its skill and endurance to fight colonial powers, from the British colonists and then the Zionist movement and the Americans embedded with the Zionist movement in the ground. You can see that in the Gaza Strip with the Delta Force. And you can see the roaming of the skies over Gaza by the Royal Air Force, British Royal Air Forces, giving coordinates to the Zionist entity. And, you know, they are the Americans and the Zionist entity, once they have the British coordinates, they can use it as they like. The British say they are trying to help in finding out the hostages, as they say, but in real terms, this is used and fed to artificial intelligence to target the Palestinians. The Palestinians know that, and the Palestinians kept manufacturing their own weapons and recycling unexploded explosions and rockets from the Zionist entity who had landed in Gaza. And if the numbers are horrendous, you know, like really scary, when you see every individual in Gaza, there's nearly 30 kilograms of explosive landed or supposed to be landed on the in his head. The amount the Israelis thrown at Gaza, and in that term, the Palestinian resistance. If you see the operations how it's been conducted from Jabalia to Shija'iya in Gaza to Khan Yunis. Multi-operations in Khan Yunis for the last month is amazed any military expertise. The precise way of planning, like they knew exactly where is the Israeli army is moving and what is coming and what kind of equipment it have, and they prepare themselves very well. This is in its own is intelligence kind of victory to the Palestinian, and an intelligence defeat to all the military or civil intelligence services or governmental intelligence services, the Israelis or the Western ones altogether. And that can show the way it's been handled. This Nahas Yehuda, one of the most fanatic units and the brigades in the Israeli army, who's tortured the people in the West Bank and as well in Syria and in the Gaza Strip. They are notorious for their fascism and the way they commit crimes, and how the Palestinian resistance managed to kill five of them, injured 14, one of them is a high-ranking officer. This is can show this Zionist entity, as Netanyahu, before he left to Washington, and this would be my last point here, told his chief of the army to tell him, Zamir, you have to cleanse the north of Gaza and send them to the south. And that's before this Beit Hanun operation, which devastated their all army. This man was brought to lead the army after the sacking of Halevi and promised Netanyahu massive victory in Gaza. Now return and confirms what the previous military chief Halevi used to say to Netanyahu, you cannot win Gaza, you cannot destroy the resistance, you cannot retrieve the captives and the unless you sit and negotiate with them. If you want to occupy the Gaza Strip, you have to throw a huge number of soldiers in there, and you have to expect huge casualties and to pay the price. The same thing now Zamir is telling Netanyahu.
Let me to jump in the conversation because I need to also bring in Mazin into this. Mazin Sayeb rightly mentioned the Operation Beit Hanun, which was a very successful one, despite nearly 2 years of unrelenting pressure, unrelenting attacks, inhumane attacks of the Israeli regime against the Palestinian forces. But the resistance is still able to manage coordinated joint attacks, such as the Quds Brigade strike on Israeli command centers, for example. I want to know, what does this joint attack, what they reveal about the logistical networks and external support that Hamas may be receiving?
Well, it clearly shows that people's will is very, very important component. I mean, nobody questions the Israeli military superiority. Israel has the most advanced weapons, and even the U.S. just approved another $560 million worth of military supplies to Israel. This would mean with the $17.5 billion before, in the past 20 months, that Israel got $18 billion of U.S. Direct aid, military aid, to commit this genocide over the past 20 months. So that's an average of about $1 billion a month in military support from the U.S. to commit this genocide. Clearly, Israel is not winning its battle against the resistance. I agree with your previous speaker, because you really cannot win against local resistance. That's not in the cards. Historically, it never happened. So Israel directs its efforts at the civilians, and that's what's happening. And so, that's the genocide continuing. And so I believe it's important, the location is also important to note. Beit Hanun, where this incident happened, is actually in the northeast of Gaza, very close to the so-called border of 1948 ceasefire line. So that had happened right there when Israel considers this area to have been cleansed of people and to have been secure for its Israeli soldiers, showed again that there is no such thing, that there is an illusion of control, and that you cannot control even that you have demolished most of Gaza.
Right, Mazen Bell. Saib, I want to talk also about Abraham Accords specifically now. Well, do you think these accords represent a betrayal of the Palestinian cause, or a pragmatic shift in Arab diplomacy?
In that, I want to bring 3 points, but yes, it is. This is the way Netanyahu acts and fill the news outlets, Western news outlets, with lots of lies. Look at our intelligence operations with the like pagers. We took the leadership in Lebanon, along with that, thousands of civilians, nurses, doctors in Lebanon. And look at our operation in Syria. We took Syria without one bullet fired, using our intelligence services. Look how we assassinate Palestinian leaderships all around the area. We win the battle with the brain, with intelligence only, and we send infiltrators to Iran to assassinate scientists or civilians or leaders in the industry or commanders from neighboring countries who are cooperating with us. And they hinting at Azerbaijan, at Erbil in Kurdistan of the north of Iraq. All of this is part of the design. But what's an operation like Beit Hanun's operation, or Khan Yunis, or Jabalia, destroy all of these lies, can prove your bragging about intelligence services and how smart and sophisticated the Western agencies who helped Netanyahu from the year of 2005 till today in Lebanon, through the assassination of Hariri and preparing the grounds for this massive destruction on the leadership of Lebanon, and all of that. So many intelligence services from the West, or even reactionary Arabs or local in there. And the same thing happened with sending infiltrators from borders, massive borders of Iran with Azerbaijan and Erbil or North Kurdistan, Iraq, and that sort of thing. But let's see in the meeting between Netanyahu and Trump what happened. There is a 3 points which is got my attention. The first one, a criminal wanted by the International Criminal Court hand a letter of recommendation to the Nobel Peace Prize for Trump, and he handed him that like he owns this criminal owns the award for the Nobel Peace Prize, which is might. The second one, when Trump said Netanyahu was asking him to lift the sanctions of Syria now and to give Syria a chance, which shows clearly Golani was his own puppet, which is all knows that. But today it's more clear when he Trump said that. And the same thing when Trump told him, our country is hot like your country about Palestine, but your country seemed very hot a few weeks, which means you are being scolded by the Iranian missiles. So the ones who's rushing today for the Abraham Accords and to the lies, which was Trump wanted to market to them, they have to be attention today.
Right. I also want to bring in Mazen into this. Regarding the Abraham Accords, I want, you're a scientist yourself, a political scientist, Mazen, tell me, in as a contrastive analysis of these policies taken by some Arab countries and the Yemeni strategies in supporting the Palestinian cause proactively by attacking with whatever they have in support of Palestine, how do you put those in two parts of the equation?
Well, we must tip our hats to the Yemenis who have stood up and said, let's obey international law and let's stop this genocide. How are we going to stop this genocide? What tool does a country like Yemen has? What tool does a country like Egypt has, or Iran or Lebanon? In the case of Yemen, it was very clear there are ships that are supplying the Zionist regime with weapons, with food, with other items that need to keep its war economy going. And these ships cannot be allowed to pass. According to international law, that's an obligation on countries to stop an ongoing genocide and ecocide, by the way, destruction of the environment. So they acted, and for that, the people of the world have been very grateful. I've seen Yemeni flags and demonstrations from Washington, D.C. to London to Paris. So people appreciate people who stand up for ending a genocide. The same thing with the Lebanese resistance and what they were able to act with limited resources they have. Now, the question really about the oppressors, in this case, imperialism and Zionism, they stretched themselves too far. So they want to take on, as Netanyahu have said, the whole Middle East, make a new Middle East, according to his words, which he had planned long before October 2023. In fact, a few weeks before October 2023, Netanyahu was bragging at the United Nations of how he's going to have a link between Asia and Europe through these collaborative Arab regimes and through what he calls the Great State of Israel or Greater Israel. This is his plan. This is the plan of Zionist leadership for decades, not a recent plan. And they stretched themselves too far and wide. And the evidence of that came, of course, on their attack on Iran. For 12 days, they pummeled Iran, killing over 1,000 Iranians, including scientists and leaders. But Iran is not somebody to push around, you know. So Iran retaliated, and it was devastating for the state of Israel. And for its supporters, they had to come rushing to save it. That's why the U.S. was told by the Zionist lobby, go attack those three nuclear facilities. And Trump obligingly did so, and he failed at that too. So both the U.S. and Israel have really failed in this grand project to reshape the Middle East to be what they would like.
Right, so I want to also, we have only 4 minutes, so 2 minutes each of you, please. I want to focus on the ceasefire talks that are ongoing and underway in Doha right now. Do you really think that Donald Trump's push for a 60-day truce or ceasefire is a genuine peace effort or just a maneuver for probably a Nobel Peace Prize?
I think yourself and the people of Iran will understand better than anybody how to trust Trump. You were negotiating, Iran was negotiating with Trump, and straight away led an attack on a country was having a nuclear negotiating with. Trump is the same man who in 2018 left the JCPOA which is the United States of America, Obama signed, with a tweet even insulted the international community, who worked 5 years on that. Trump, the man who assassinated the top commander, Soleimani, in 2020, So this kind of guy, he plays at a great deceptive operation against the regional governments or the resistance. So this man cannot be trusted whatsoever. Any American negotiator like Woodcock or anybody in Doha cannot be trusted. The Palestinian resistance, now its cards is stronger after its military operation in there. And in that, we can see that in the amendments the Palestinians put to Woodcock proposals. So the Israel, the resistance saying, we want 1, 2, 3, 4, which is 60 days after that will be negotiation about ceasefire or ending the whole operation. But if the Zionist entity refuse that and want to go in the moving sand of Gaza, they are welcome. This is what the resistance saying. We are capable. We have our incubators who is facing genocide is still behind the resistance. And even the Zionist entity intelligence services the last couple of days were saying Hamas itself, it's built itself with forces up to the same level it was pre the 7th of October. So this is an Israeli kind of information about that. So they can themselves accept the fact that as Netanyahu try Trump and Netanyahu floating the idea of the between themselves in front of the journalists, right. Simon, the Palestinian two-state solution.
I have to jump in for the sake of the conversation and time. Just 30 seconds for you, Mazin. Do you think this temporary ceasefire could realistically lead to a permanent truce?
The answer is no. Israel has broken ceasefires that they have signed before. As mentioned, they cannot be trusted. The Israeli government wants to continue this war because it keeps them in power. And it keeps their public from turning against each other. But they are failing at all fronts, diplomatically and everything. And they hope the U.S. will save them via forcing the Palestinian resistance to surrender, which, of course, will never happen. So things will continue, I think, for a while until the international community wakes up. And there are signs that the international community is waking up, so I am optimistic.
Thank you so much, gentlemen, for participating in our talk and in yet another spotlight here. Mr. Saeb Sharf, author and commentator, joining us from Belfast, and also Mr. Mazin Qumsi, a Palestinian scientist and author, joining us from Bethlehem. And to you, thank you so much for staying with us on another spotlight.
Chased by wolves, followed by a hawk. On the battlefield, you took your final walk. It took my breath when you said goodbye. But then again, heroes never die. Your final words were stay the course. Trust in God, the everlasting source. Don't give in to the enemy's plots. Resist with faith. Go against the odds. Your way I follow, oh my hero. Unbreakable soul, unstoppable power. Until the last breath, you never surrender. Unshakable faith, unwavering sacrifice. Make you the hero we'll remember forever. Your blood was spilled, but it nourished my roots. I then became a tree with many fruits. The fruits are love, courage, and resolve. You've made me a soldier, so you I salute. Your way I follow,
unbreakable soul, unstoppable power. Until the last breath, you never surrender. Unshakable faith, unwavering sacrifice, make you the hero we'll remember forever. A hero. A unshakable faith, unwavering sacrifice, make you the hero we'll remember forever. A hero.
Rabbana, Rabbana.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we will be examining a question which is related to the month we are currently in. As you know, this is the month of Muharram, and this month is significant because in this month, the grandson of the Holy Prophet, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, was martyred along with some of his companions and friends on the plains of Karbala. So here at IRIB English Radio and The Key, we would like to offer our condolences to our esteemed listeners on this very sad event. In order to answer the question we want to pose today, we will take reference to hadith. The question actually is, what are the virtues of Imam Hussein? The reason why we pose this question is that until we don't know the virtues of the Imam alayhi salam, it becomes difficult for us to understand why his martyrdom is so significant and why his death and his murder was so important and so sad. Why is it so such a solemn event? In order to answer this question, let's look at some hadith in which some of the virtues of Imam Hussein have been reflected and manifested. In one beautiful hadith, a person named Hudhaifa ibn al-Yaman narrates, "I saw the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam holding the hand of Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam, saying, O people, this is Hussein ibn Ali. So acknowledge him by he who holds my life in his hand. Verily, he will be in paradise. Those who love him will be in paradise, and those who love his lovers will be in paradise." And in another hadith, a person named Shu'ayb ibn Abdul Rahman al-Khuza'i said, "A mark," so like a wound or a mark or a mark was seen on Imam Hussein alayhi salam's back on the day of Taf, meaning Ashura. So they asked Zain al-Abidin about it, alayhi salam. And he replied, "This is the mark, the wound, left by the sacks of food he carried on his back to the houses of widows, orphans, and the destitute." And in another hadith, it's been narrated that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, on the death, on the day of Ashura, said the following: "Death is better than embarking on a life of indignity, and indignity is preferable over plunging into the fire." A reporter has said, "By God, I have never seen a defeated one whose children, household, and companions have all been killed as calm as him. The men," meaning the enemies, "were fighting harshly with him, and he too was harsh with them with his sword. He attacked an enemy of 30,000, scattered them in front of him as if they were scattered locusts. He then returned to his base, saying, "There is no power or strength save in God. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah al-ali al-azim. Save in God, the Most High, the Most Supreme." These were some of the virtues of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the virtues of Imam Hussein alayhi salam in the light of the hadith of the infallibles alayhi wasalam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Good morning to you all. You are tuned into Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran. We start with our morning news bulletin and we round up this hour's program with two episodes of our varied radio productions feature, broadcasted one after another.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's parliament speaker says Israel was forced to stop its recent war on the country as the regime was militarily incapable of keeping up with its aggression. Israel's genocidal war rages on in Gaza, claimed the lives of dozens more civilians in the regime's indiscriminate air and artillery strikes. Hamas slammed Netanyahu's remarks about the impossibility of a comprehensive truce deal for Gaza as a sign of his malicious efforts to obstruct ceasefire talks. Hello and welcome. You've tuned into World News from Tehran with me, Zakaria Zainab. Thank you so much for joining us. Iran's parliament speaker says cessation of Israel's recent war of aggression was only caused by the regime's military failure rather than its restraint. Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf was speaking in a live interview on the 12th-day U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. Ghalibaf asserted that Iranian missile strikes in the final days of the cessation were more than 90% accurate and disabled key Israeli military and air defense systems. He said Iran had free access to any targets across the occupied territories, and this is why Israel was forced to seek a truce. Ghalibaf further noted that an actual Israeli casualties were far higher than official figures. He cited scientific models suggesting that 3,500 injuries officially reported should be interpreted as at least 500 deaths. He argued that Iran faced not only Israel but also the entire NATO and Western powers under U.S. command. The parliament speaker also touched on the indirect talks with the U.S., saying Washington launched attacks on Iran while Tehran was engaged in negotiation. He said the U.S. must compensate for its aggression and broken promises if it is sincere in its offers of diplomacy. Political commentator Tony Goslin says he believes the direct involvement of the U.S. in the Israeli war of aggression on Iran was meant to save the regime from a defeat.
It looked to me as if the dramatic two-bomber strike on Iran by the United States was really to save Netanyahu's face. He was losing that conflict and losing it fast. Even though he was the one that started it on the first day of the Stockholm Bilderberg conference to impress the military-industrial complex, what's happened was he needed a way out of that, which keeps him his political cachet going. And Trump handed him that with that strike. That enabled the ceasefire between Iran and Israel to take place. The likelihood is that if an exchange between Israel and Iran happens again in the future, that the Israelis is going to become pretty clear that the Israeli state, that is to say the military and the political structure in Israel, will suffer far more than the Iranians.
Iran's foreign minister says Tehran is open to resuming negotiation with the U.S. based on dignity and mutual respect. Abbas Araghchi, however, stressed that the U.S. must first change its behavior and guarantee that it will not launch another military strike against Iran amid the talks. In an interview with France Le Monde, Araghchi said U.S. attack has damaged Iran's nuclear facilities and the country reserved the right to ask for compensation after the scope of the damage is determined. He emphasized that the United States must accept responsibility for its mistakes towards Iran as a prerequisite for renewing talks. Iran's foreign minister emphasized that further sanctions or military threat will undermine diplomacy. Araghchi also referred to suggestion by the three European countries that they might activate the sanction mechanism planned in 2015 nuclear deal. He said such a move will be equal to a military attack and end Europe's role in talks on Iran's peaceful nuclear program. Araghchi noted that Iran has no plan to leave the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and remains committed to it, but also believes that the treaty should not be applied in a one-sided manner. Dozens more Palestinian civilians lose their lives in Israel's indiscriminate strikes in Gaza as the regime presses ahead with its genocidal war on the blockaded territory. In one of the latest attacks, nearly a dozen citizens were killed and several others injured after the bombing of a school which houses displaced persons. In Jabalia and Nazla, northern Gaza, two Palestinians were killed and nearly 20 others injured, most of them children, in an airstrike on a home in the Al Shayti refugee camp west of Gaza City. An airstrike in northern Gaza also killed five Palestinians from the same family. Separate Israeli air and artillery attacks killed over half a dozen civilians.